Welcome to Vicom's Weekly Podcast. I'm James Serene, I'm Vicom's CEO. We start our podcast this week with an interview with Yochanan Plesner at the Israel Democracy Institute.
Yochanan, thank you so much for joining the Hadion podcast. Really great to be here with you in the IDI, the Israeli Democracy Institute in Jerusalem. Yesterday, it was announced that the Attorney General has given the Prime Minister more time to prepare for his hearing. It will likely be in early October. But we've also been reading about discussions over various moves that could help Netanyahu get immunity. One's the so-called immunity law, which would revert the situation back to how it was in 2005, where all MKs had automatic immunity, and removing it would require a vote in the House committee and then the Knesset plenum. There was some opposition to this in Likud, and seemingly, if we can believe reports, that's now off the agenda. And the other is what's known as, you know, the override clause, which is considered far more serious and would limit the Supreme Court's ability to strike down decisions or legislation passed by the Knesset. Therefore, if the Knesset were to grant Netanyahu immunity, no one would be able to petition the court to remove it afterwards. For those non-legal experts among us, can you briefly take us through what this means and what you think might happen?
Well, you thanks, first of all, for having me, and you gave quite a concise and accurate overview of the situation. The main thing that is at stake in this point is what you called an override clause, which in a sense is a set or a series of measures that are designed to undermine and subvert both the independence and scope of authority of the Supreme Court in its ability to conduct judicial review over Knesset decisions and over legislation. This is really what matters and what's at stake, because given the current legislation or former legislation, there are legal ways of obtaining immunity for politicians. The real question is if it's done in an improper manner and in a manner that is not what this immunity law was designed for in the first place, which is to disallow the law enforcement institutions to intervene in politics. But if somebody is suspicious of corruption charges, and then no immunity law should be available to them in no system of government. And therefore, the Supreme Court is likely to intervene like it did in the past and annul whatever decision to grant immunity in whatever track. And therefore, the big move is to get the Supreme Court out of the picture, take it out of the picture. And this is really what's at stake, because it has far-reaching implications both for the whole question of immunity for politicians. It might turn the Knesset into a safe haven for criminals, but it has even much broader consequences, because the current the kind of override clauses that are required in order to remove the Supreme Court out of the picture are in a sense an eradication of the majority of the tools that are available to ensure the rule of law in Israel. So it's a much broader issue than specifically immunity. It's like you take out an entire neighborhood in order to bomb a specific building.
So back in February, Vicom did a paper about the investigations, and we spoke to several people at the IDI who are real experts on this. And when we were discussing the different scenarios, so one scenario was after the hearing, the Attorney General indicts Netanyahu on a series of charges, and Netanyahu then goes to the Knesset and tries to, you know, with a majority vote to grant him immunity. And when we discussed it back in February, the impression was this would be, it would be so cynical, the idea of, you know, the AG not acting in good faith, or the idea that it would be against the public interest, or the idea that he could get a majority for such a thing was seen as fantasy. Now it's late May 2019, it's after the elections. So I wanted to ask you, from your perspective, based on what we know now, what do you think the chances of that particular scenario happening and actually taking place?
Well, yesterday's fantastic and unrealistic scenarios turned out to be today's reality. And I was one of those who thought that nobody would even dare to request immunity from prosecution in the case of charges that have nothing to do with the conduct of a public figure. The whole idea of an immunity was to protect public figures, members of Knesset. I was one of them, in order to conduct their public job, not in order to perpetrate crimes. So yeah, it was completely unrealistic. It's a lot more likely that this will be an attempt to provide immunity would take place. I still think it will not pass. I still do not see a majority of members of Knesset voting in a sense, in a way that helps turn the Knesset, our parliament, into a safe haven for criminals. It has no justification. It creates a huge damage to a wonderful system of law enforcement and protection of rule of law that we've built over 70 years. And I know that in closed rooms, many of the Likud members think that it's completely unjustified. And I hope some of them will also get the courage in order to vote against it.
Great. Okay, well, I'm sure we'll continue the conversation in the future. Yochanan, thank you so much.
I look forward to it. Thank you.
So, Kalev, your interview there with Yochanan, I thought very interesting. And I think there's one point there that I wanted to just pick up on, and then we can discuss some other issues. It's very interesting where he said that really the purpose of the immunity law is to protect people in the exercise of their public kind of official functions. It's not to protect people when they commit crimes. I mean, obviously, you know, Prime Minister Netanyahu's lawyers are very good, and I'm sure that he and others can make an argument that some of the circumstances in the case where he was in the exercise of his public kind of official functions, but others clearly were not. I mean, do you think that there is starting to be a kind of chink in the arm here, that we've got more people perhaps in the coalition who are going to not vote for this immunity to be given to Prime Minister Netanyahu? It only takes 5 people, doesn't it, to say no. We already know that Gideon Saar is one of those, potentially. What do you think is going to happen to get to those other 4?
So just thinking back to the February paper that we did, and one of the things we were quite clear about was that there's 2 parallel lines going on. There's a legal line and there's a political line. And I think your initial comments, James, refer back to the legal issues, but actually this is being played out on the political realm. And if you can convince enough people that Netanyahu deserves immunity, it doesn't really matter, in theory, what the law was meant for. You can politically force through immunity. I mean, Saar came out, his opposition was for an immunity law. It wasn't necessarily to stop Netanyahu from or forcing Netanyahu to stand down after he was indicted. And I think, you know, we've said this a few times, that there's this traditional thing that basically Labour are constantly swapping leaders. But Likud, historically, have supported their leaders. I know Anshul Fefe, who we've spoken to a lot, talks about this. They've only really been in kind of, 70 years, 4 different leaders of Likud. So getting rid of a Likud leader who has proven himself over and over again as an electoral asset would be a major thing. But one of the things Yochanan was saying is he finds it, you know, maybe we all suffer from a failure of imagination, but he finds it difficult to believe that, you know, bribery is a very, very serious charge. It's difficult to believe that you would get to 61, but it's a lot easier to believe you could get to 61 than it was several months ago. And even today, there was a member of Kulanu who, you know, we all thought that Kulanu would definitely not support Netanyahu after an indictment, also beginning to walk back statements. So there could be chinks in the armour, but that scenario is easier to understand or to imagine than it was back in January, February.
I mean, it's quite complicated, but there have been 2 processes as well that have been going on. And it's probably a sense of sort of testing the waters. I mean, first there was this big issue of a new immunity law, whereby you have a new piece of legislation that specifically creates a new set of circumstances which will grant immunity to people and sort of does something new and reverts back to the situation before 2005. It creates an automatic presumption that no members of Knesset should ever face prosecution unless the Knesset votes to to make them face prosecution, which puts the presumption on the Knesset to sort of, you know, let them face trial. What seems to be happening here is that Netanyahu has decided that's too far to go, and that's too much of a leap. So he's going to rely on the existing situation, which we've discussed, is basically you get a majority in the House committee, not so difficult, the coalition has a majority there. Then you take it to the Knesset floor, a majority of 120 Knesset members, and that basically goes on political lines, you know, and who's going to break ranks. And those people who break ranks will know that they have essentially ensured that the Prime Minister, the legal process continues and could eventually unseat him. So it's a lot of pressure on them. I mean, I suppose my next question is, how much do you think that building up ahead of steam by the opposition parties and others is going to have an effect on the immunity vote itself, and whether that's going to be enough to potentially change the minds of some of the members of Knesset? Do you detect that there is a movement out there that's going to pressure these Knesset members to decide to sort of break ranks?
I just add an additional component to what you said. As you said, the Knesset House Committee, automatic majority, not difficult. 61 in the plenum. You would hope that with a majority, I mean, you as in Likud or Netanyahu would hope that with a majority of 65, he could get the votes. And there's an additional component, which is the override clause, because even if you were to get the votes, yeah, someone would petition the Supreme Court immediately. You know, there's a precedent for ministers having to stand down once an indictment is filed against them. And then the open question is, well, is a prime minister, you know, more than just a minister, as in should a prime minister definitely have to stand down? Or is a prime minister, because they've, you know, in some ways been directly voted in, should that prime minister be allowed, you know, the rule for a minister is not the rule for a prime minister. But if you have a override clause of the Supreme Court, then no one can petition you. So that in some ways neutralizes the Supreme Court component, and it allows you with a majority in the Knesset, in the House Committee and in the plenum to be fine.
So let's just, I think we should probably explain that because in Israel it's being just called the override clause. And I think we need to try and explain it to an English-speaking audience that essentially what this is you are limiting the power for what we understand, particularly in the UK, to be the judicial review power of the Supreme Court to basically review and disqualify or strike down what the Knesset has passed. And essentially at the moment, the Israeli Supreme Court, like a lot of other Supreme Courts, the US and UK, similar kind of powers that they can judicially review, they can disqualify laws that the Knesset passes and say, no, that is unconstitutional, that is illegal, you're beyond your powers, etc. And they can also hear challenges, like you say, from particular votes. So what, as I understand it, this is all about is essentially reducing that power, and it's on a scale, isn't it? It's either you reduce its power to judiciary review certain decisions that might just be about the administration of the Knesset, so it could just be about this very narrow issue of how you deal with your sort of errant members of Knesset and their misbehavior, and that could cover this particular issue. Or, like, there are some people in potentially the future coalition who want to extend that not just to administrative decisions of the Knesset, but to actually things much wider, and even potentially to sort of all legislation, so that, you know, if, for instance, the Knesset annexes the whole of the West Bank and that law is then, you know, taken to the Supreme Court, then, the Supreme Court would then not be empowered to do anything with it. So that's how I understand it. That's pretty much correct, is it? Tell me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, no, that is correct. But I think, I mean, there's different factors at play here, because there is an argument, which some people reject, that the Supreme Court is overly activist, that it overly gets involved in things that the Knesset passes. Now, actually, the IDI, who I spoke to earlier, have actually rejected that. And they've said, actually, you know, statistically, that's not the case. But there is a feeling that the Supreme Court doesn't really allow the Knesset to do its job. I think, you know, and Fathom is actually bringing out an interview with Eliakim Rubinstein in the next couple of weeks where he talks about that the balance between the two branches is a very legitimate debate to have. But there are others who are in some ways piggybacking on that to try and do serious damage to the Supreme Court itself. And I think, you know, it's important to try and distinguish between what is the correct balance between the judicial branch and the legislative branch on the one hand, and specific things that are directly meant to neuter the Supreme Court. But yes, if an override clause were to be put in, it would basically allow the Knesset free rein to make decisions, and there'd be no recourse for the Supreme Court getting involved. And that, in theory, would allow Netanyahu to have immunity. I think my feeling is Netanyahu's probably... people who talk about Netanyahu over the last decade has not been one of those people who has sought to neuter or even significantly weaken the Supreme Court. My feeling is he's kind of piggybacking on this kind of feeling that people have, and what some other people are trying to seriously neuter it, and Netanyahu's exploiting that to try and pass this very personalized piece of legislation through.
Yeah, I mean, there's this theory, isn't there? There's Netanyahu of sort of pre-2015, there's 2015 Netanyahu, and now there's 2019 Netanyahu. And 2019 Netanyahu is very focused on his own personal survival, on these particular cases that go to the heart of, you know, his own, you know, family's welfare and what's actually going to happen to them. You know, it's a deeply personal, and so kind of Netanyahu 2019 may not follow the principles of sort of, you know, earlier versions of him, but we shall see. So I think, you know, to sum up, we're probably looking at somewhere on a scale, aren't we? And we're either looking at, you know, this immunity law gets passed, maybe there is some kind of limitations put on the power of the Supreme Court, and that will fall in the way that we've kind of set out, or the immunity law doesn't pass, and that would be a pretty big moment. There'll be a lot of pressure on those members of Knesset that, you know, stuck their necks out and voted against it, and then we would have kind of game on, as it were, in terms of the legal process that we thought we were looking at earlier, which would be hearing with the Attorney General, then it potentially goes to a criminal trial. So there are very big stakes here. Very, very big indeed. I wanted to just move on slightly to then talk about where we are with the coalition negotiations, because I think, you know, certainly there's a real sense of, like, you know, what's actually going on here? Is this all game playing? We've had a lot of reports of coalition discussions having stopped. We've got a kind of split between Yisrael Beiteinu, sort of the secular right, versus the ultra-Orthodox what you might call national religious parties, and very different views. I suppose the fault line is around religion and state. It's around Judaism in the public sphere. It's about things like the Western Wall, egalitarian prayer agreement, conversion, ultra-Orthodox men serving in the army. I mean, where do you think this is going to land? I mean, we've got the deadline next Tuesday, the 28th. You know, Netanyahu has to have a government by then. Do you think this is all just going to fall into place, that we're going to just be yawning and looking at this coalition agreement and think, oh, this, you know, this is pretty much what it was in 2015? Or do you think there's more drama to come?
I think if it weren't to fall into place, it would be absolutely huge news. It would be very, very significant. Yeah, there'd be new elections, and that's never happened before. So all of those things suggest...
Sorry, if it doesn't fall into place...
If it doesn't fall into place, then it would be absolutely huge news. And unprecedented. Yeah. So we would assume then that it will, in the end, fall into place. But we are running out of time. B, as you said, there continue to be very core disagreements between Yisrael Beiteinu and the religious and ultra-Orthodox parties, which perhaps in the past could have been fudged in some way. But there's a very real issue of the conscription law for ultra-Orthodox males that either will be passed or won't be. So that's kind of harder to fudge. I think the other thing that makes it harder for Netanyahu that analysts have been talking about here, in the past, everyone wanted to be the first one to sign an agreement, because if you got into the coalition and you could guarantee what you wanted. Now, everyone wants to wait until the last minute, because they realize the closer it gets, the more pressure and stress Likud will be under, and the more these smaller parties will be able to squeeze them. Mm. Conducting negotiations when every side wants to wait until the last minute has the potential for being very, very problematic. And the last people who want to sign is Kulanu and Moshe Kachlon, because he's likely to be the finance minister, and he wants to know how much all of this is going to cost before he signs on. So the dynamics of the negotiation process are you know, in some ways, the differing issues we've always had in previous coalition negotiations, they've always somehow managed to find a way to solve it or to fudge it or whatever. I think the added component here is the issue of time, that everyone wants to wait to be the last one. And we're running out of time. You know, I would be very surprised if it didn't happen. But with a few days to go, there are still very, very serious issues that I don't really see how they're going to solve.
So they may just kick the can down the road and lay within the coalition agreement the seeds of its own sort of collapse some way down the line. Because, I mean, it doesn't seem like there's a natural way to solve some of these problems about, say, ultra-orthodox conscription or some of the other issues. And I think also there's potentially going to be a big bill in terms of public spending. And, you know, economists were already, and even the Bank of Israel or others, were talking about, you know, spending commitments even before the coalition negotiations started, and talking about that, you know, there may need to be tax increases. And these are the commitments that the government, you know, already signed up to. And we're not talking about potentially new ones. So that'll be very interesting. And I read in that is why Kahlon is certainly waiting, because he doesn't want to be the finance minister that has to, you know, bring in tax cuts and, you know, be the unpopular fool guy. So that's fascinating. I wanted to just ask you a final question, which is about this US plan for Israeli-Palestinian talks, the so-called deal of the century. We've had a lot of to-ing and fro-ing this week about the Palestinians are boycotting this meeting in Bahrain where they're going to talk about, you know, an economics workshop where they're going to try and talk about, you know, future support for the Palestinians. Palestinians are boycotting. UAE and Saudi Arabia say they're going. Israel hasn't said anything about this, to my knowledge. Correct me if I'm wrong. What's going on there? Are they just waiting it out, or are we just going to see a point where quietly it's confirmed that, I don't know, Tzachi Hanegbi is going to attend? What do you think?
I think there's a few different things at play here. I mean, the Palestinian national movement has a history of rejectionism, even with Clinton and Bush and Obama. And so, you know, in that sense, it's not overly surprising that they're not jumping over themselves to go to a Trump administration sponsored economic workshop when the administration has already done things that are considered to be very pro-Israel. They've stopped funding UNRWA, they've moved the embassy, etc., etc.
So why is Israel not sort of jumping at it and saying, we're coming?
So the Palestinian perspective isn't surprising. I think, you know, the Israeli perspective, Netanyahu's in a bit of a bind. He has he's really thrown everything in with the Trump administration. They're very, very close. We don't know what the political components of the plan are going to be. In some ways, you know, the economics is, I don't want to say it's a sideshow, but what's going to put the cat amongst the pigeons, certainly for the Israeli coalition, is going to be the political aspect. And so I think Netanyahu is kind of caught between, on the one hand, his closeness with the Trump administration, and on the other hand, the coalition that is coalescing, it looks like it's going to be completely opposed to certainly far-reaching, maybe even minimal, territorial concessions. So if that is your coalition, but Trump is your closest ally, you've got a bit of a problem. Now, Netanyahu in the past has always managed to kind of get out of these sorts of challenges, but it wouldn't surprise me if, while the coalition negotiations are continuing, Israel try and keep as quiet as possible. I think Netanyahu will try and go out of his way to not reject the plan. But, you know, they've got no problems with the economic aspect. The big question will be, what are the political components of it? Yeah. I just add one last thing, which, you know, I think we at BICOM are in a bit of a bind, because in our forecasting paper, we said the plan's not going to get published. So, you know, clearly the economic workshop is going ahead. I actually think it's still an open question whether after the economic workshop and people feedback, and we've already said, you know, come September, everything's going to be more on the 2020 re-election, etc. I still think it's an open question whether the political components are going to be published or not.
Yeah, whether it happens at all, still possible that it won't be published at all. So you think Israel will send some kind of delegation to this conference, but essentially the political element will be really what everyone will be focusing on in Israel?
Yeah, I think there's no, there's no, certainly if the Saudis and the Emiratis are there, it's a fantastic, if nothing else, photo opportunity for Israel. But, you know, the plan will not rise and fall on the economic aspects. The real question is, what are the political components of it? And, you know, we're almost certain it will be rejected by the Palestinians. But for me, the more interesting question is, how is Netanyahu going to bridge the gap between the potential positions of the Trump administration and the positions of his coalition? I think that's going to be a real challenge.
Yeah, I mean, I would applaud my own work, but I did an article for the Times of Israel Jewish News last week all about what we think might happen, and I really concluded that it's between two possibilities. One possibility is that is that the plan is actually very vague on some of these political questions. It talks about some of the things that Netanyahu has talked about in terms of like a state minus and, you know, some kind of Palestinian autonomy. It doesn't talk about anything to do with removing settlements in isolated areas. And that's kind of in some ways within the comfort zone of most of the coalition. Or it proposes something far more radical, in which case it puts the coalition outside of its comfort zone and it causes problems. So, yeah, but, you know, people might conclude that everything we've seen and heard from the Trump administration so far would dictate that it might be the former rather than the latter. But as always, things we shall see. I think we will leave it there. Caleb, thank you so much. You've been a great person to talk to on all this and also for your interview with Jochanan Plesner earlier. So thank you very much.
Great. Thanks, James. Good to see you.
Thank you.